The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Plus, we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to a special Saturday edition of Coffee House Shots. On this week's episode, we're broadcasting the full-length version of a discussion that was first on Spectator TV between Freddie Gray, Kate Andrews, and Paul Mason, the author and journalist.
Now, I think it's fair to say that the Conservative Party has not given Britain the thriving economy that some people hoped it might. But what would a British economy look like under Labour? We had a bit of a glimpse this week from Rachel Reeves, who delivered the Mays lecture, in which she outlined her vision, her economic vision, her political vision, really, for where she thinks Britain is going and where she thinks the global economy is going. I'm very pleased to be joined by Paul Mason, author and journalist and expert on all things left. You are currently writing a history of communism. A critical history of communism. We'll see about that. And, of course, Kate Andrews, the Spectator's economics editor. Paul, I'll start with you. You've both written pieces on the Spectator's website about her speech, Rachel Reeves' speech. And, Paul, you start off by saying she's effectively declared neoliberalism is dead, although she didn't use the word neoliberal because that's left speak. What do you mean by that?
How long have you got? Well, look, we on the left refer to the economic paradigm that opened up in the 1980s as neoliberalism. What do I mean by it? It's the original Washington consensus. Mm. Free markets, financialized economies, heavily in the end indebted economies. Economies that, let's say, in the global north and developed world have delivered high degrees of inequality. So what Rachel Reeves said last night on the Mays lecture was that certainly globalization, as we've known it, is over, and the presumed benefits of globalization are no longer there. And like, therefore, Joe Biden, increasingly like the European Commission, what Rachel wants to do is to put the nation first and say the national economy and its stability is important to us, and its ability to deliver, from Labour's point of view, redistribution, not only between sectors of the different classes, as it were, but between regions of the United Kingdom, that too is a policy goal. That moves us on from Blairism. Blairism presumed everything about globalisation was benign, and that the more interconnected the economy could be, that the more we'd get out of it. So I think she's got the diagnosis. The other thing, interesting thing she said was, any economic model, and therefore any economic policy regime, that is built on the presumption of stability is going to not work. So that's quite a big thing. If you're an academic economist, they're sitting there and their mental model is that everything that moves slightly away from stability will at some point come back into equilibrium if they only take some policy actions. Rachel's really saying that's no longer the case. Now, on the basis of that analysis, she then builds a prognosis. What's she going to do? Unlike the Tories, we don't think Labour, I'm a Labour supporter, we don't think simply cutting taxes and therefore stimulating demand side of the economy is going to boost growth. You need to do something on the supply side, and she calls this new supply side economics, following Janet Yellen's lead. It is about, and you can't borrow and you can't tax much more, so you've just basically got to do one thing: de-risk private investment in order that private money, which is sitting there, and it is there, tangibly there, moves into the UK economy and into the kind of investment that can boost the output potential of the economy long term. I think that's my version of May's lecture.
Yes. Well, it's a pretty good summary. you mentioned Biden there and Yellen. And in your piece, in fact, you mentioned that people have criticised Labour's economic vision as Bidenomics without the money.
Yeah.
Why do you think it will work, or how do you think it can work?
We sure as hell don't have the money. Okay, yeah. That's and I think you won't find anybody in a position of authority in Labour who will deviate from that. It's not, we've got a tax base, we've got a public spending base at 48-49% of GDP. We've got a very high tax base, I think it's 44. We've got debt to GDP will probably peak around about 99% if the OBR is right. So you have to do everything through crowding in. You have to do everything through changing the regulatory the regulatory space, whether it's for solar power, whether it's for planning for, you know, pylons and battery farms, or whether it's looking on the financial side, Labour is well aware that, you know, the not just pension funds, but investment funds are just waiting for an environment where there can be regulatory certainty. That's it. That is, if you apply, if you, there are guys with portfolios, billions worth of portfolios of potential solar farms in Britain, billions. And all they ever say to me is, yes, another one's been called in by Michael Gove. Liz Truss is on my case. And their investors, sitting in you know, parts unknown in the world, are saying, well, until you can sort this out, we've got plenty of other places in the world that want solar farms. Mm. And Labour's basically pinning a lot, and this is part of my concern about it. They're pinning, I don't know what you think, they're pinning a lot on the idea that they can de-risk investment and therefore that the money will come. And I think the proof of this is going to be in the pudding. It's all about execution. And how many corporate stories have we seen where the plan is good and the shareholders buy the plan, but the chief exec cannot execute? And I think that's where Rachel Reeves has now put herself. She's got to now execute this plan.
Yes. Kate, Rachel Reeves calls it securonomics, but at the same time, she's saying there's no such thing as stability in the modern global economy. Does she give you any comfort with this idea of a kind of a state-driven long-term investment?
I doubt Rachel Reeves and I see eye to eye when it really comes down to the size of the state. But where I think Paul is completely correct, and what I found quite interesting about the speech, is that it seemed like a message to business, and she was using her Mace lecture, using her address to the city as her moment to do this, to basically say, hey guys, I need your money. And Paul is completely right. The money isn't going to come essentially through any other means apart from private investment. This idea of de-risking private investment makes me a bit nervous, because I think that is often how we find ourselves in a situation where promises have been made to business that essentially they can't fail. But Rachel Reeves's promise in her Mace lecture was that she doesn't want the economy to fail your average worker. She almost wants to make that, you know, that baseline of the economy too big to fail. It's a big promise, and I think there are huge questions about how exactly you could, any government could possibly deliver that. But I think she was trying to make business feel pretty relaxed, pretty confident that she wasn't going to do anything too radical, but she wanted the private money to come in. And what she's identified, I think, is broadly speaking right. If we look at the past 15 years, for example, no, let's look at the past 30 years. You know, let's go back through consecutive governments of different parties. You always prioritize the short-term gains over the long-term capital investment. And that's why school roofs are falling in. That's why you have the RAC scandal. That's why you just don't have proper investment in infrastructure. I mean, it's one of the many reasons, frankly. Some questions for Labour. Are they really, when push comes to shove, going to be the ones to say, actually, guys, we're not going to invest more in day-to-day NHS spending with the money we have. We're going to look long-term? Probably not. So what they want to do is find the private money so that they can ideally do both at the same time. On, you know, the more critical side is wishful thinking. On the more optimistic side, perhaps they're saying to business, give us the chance, because you haven't given us a chance in quite some time to prove to you that we're going to be stable about this. And where I think it's most important and interesting for Labour is on the supply side reform that Paul was talking about. The Tories have been talking about supply side reform for the past 14 years. We haven't seen it. Where are the homes? Where is the energy infrastructure? If Labour were to actually deregulate some of this stuff, actually get some homes built, and crucially get some green energy infrastructure built, that is where companies are saying, the money is here, the money is ready, we are desperate to build this. Why is it going to take 15 years if it happens at all? If they can tackle some of that, if they can really get Britain building anything, build anything, I think Labour could actually see some very serious gains when it comes to economic growth, when it comes to prosperity, people feeling better off. I would just say, though, I mean, these are huge assumptions that they're going to be able to pull this off. There is a reason for 14 years the Tory government has struggled to do this. I don't think it's because of lack of desire, frankly. I think it's because politically, some of these projects are very, very difficult.
You talk about people feeling better off, and isn't that really the big problem for Western governments now? And that, you know, Bidenomics is very popular in wonk world. All the macroeconomic indicators seem to suggest it's working. You know, the Economist front cover last week was the American superpower firing up again. But Americans don't feel it. Workers don't feel it. They don't feel their wages have gone up in line with inflation. They don't feel the benefits yet. They might in the coming months. We'll see. But is this partly the problem? This is just the fashionable economics in think tank worlds, in sort of Rachel Reeves' circle, in the Biden circle. but it doesn't make people happier and it doesn't make people feel more prosperous.
To work, it has to be phased, and the phasing is important. What Biden's done is he's thrown both state money and state subsidy, and he has actually attracted capital. How many stories have we heard of UK entrepreneurs faced with... I mean, I've heard of UK entrepreneurs literally considering moving their entire operation and plonking it back down in North Africa because... North America, because the incentives for investors are so clear in the USA. Now, that won't feed through to feed through to higher wages. There are several second-order effects that that's got. Higher real wages, there are second-order effects. In a much more welfarist economy like Britain, there are swings and roundabouts. So you've already, if you can make the NHS work, if you can make, and that's a
big if.
Yeah, big if. But I think it can happen. If you can make the primary and secondary education system work for everybody, not just for, say, London and a few whatever, if you can get the infrastructure there, then things start to happen. But I think this will take them two terms. Let me give you an example. The so-called Golden Triangle, not the poorest part of Britain, London, Oxford, Cambridge. There's a lot of talk and a lot of potential to develop that as a kind of North Carolina-style tech hub of the United Kingdom. Doesn't solve South Wales's problem, doesn't solve Newcastle's problem, but it would be a great thing to do. What's the problem? In Cambridge, putting it crudely, there's not enough water. In Oxford, there's not enough electricity grid capacity. The local councils can't deal with it. County councils can't deal with it. There's no economic planning body. And when we get an industrial strategy council, when you get the National Wealth Fund, and you get these institutions that Rachel was talking about in the lecture, if you do it right, at some point, a guiding intelligence comes in and says, we can sort both problems. And then the whole, I can't forget the name of the road and the railway track in between, there is an economic space in between Oxford and Cambridge that could be highly developed, just like the North Carolina, triangle. That's what we're talking about. But that's not going to happen in year one. It's not going to happen by year five, maybe by year 10. And by then, you'll be able to point backwards, we have a new paradigm. Just as, remember, my community, I come from a mining community in the north of England, was devastated by Thatcherism. No one would have pointed in 1985 to look at the success we're having. They were highly unhappy. And I think that's the only parallel she's actually drawing, by the way, with Thatcherism. It's going to take time. So I think it's more than the fashionable thing, my fashionable theory. But I do say publicly and privately to Labour people, you cannot assume that everything goes right. To the extent that it goes wrong, you might have to do radical things that you've told people you're not going
to
do.
To what extent, Kate, is this new paradigm that we're talking about, is it no longer capitalist but corporatist? In the sense, what you're really having is governments working with big businesses saying, we'll give you these incentives, we'll give you these breaks, but you have to go along with our agenda on whatever it is, whether it's energy or anything else.
This is where I get a lot more critical of Securenomics or Bidenomics. The sugar rush that the U.S. has experienced has led to really impressive growth figures. But if you poll the American people, they don't feel better off. I think they recognize a lot of this as a sugar high. They are not convinced about financial security in the future. So when you ask them, is the economy really so bad? They say, well, no, but I'm not convinced that this is going to continue. And of course, the way that a lot of those businesses have been lured to the U.S. is through tax credits and the rest. And, Labor are leaving a lot of open questions about that. I understand if you don't have to commit to something right away, don't do it. Then people will scrutinize you. When they do commit to something, the Tories tend to take their ideas. So maybe they're a little more hesitant to do so. But, I think there's still a lot of outstanding questions about whether or not a sugar rush in the U.K., A, could really be afforded if the government could really pile the money in to do that. And B, whether or not it would lead to that long-term success. Rachel Reeves said in her speech, this might sound a bit protectionist. This industrial strategy might sound like picking winners and losers. I promise it isn't. And all I could really glean from what she said is this time it will be different. I'm never terribly convinced that it's different. I'm never terribly convinced that if you grow a bloated state to an even bigger size, as Paul said, we're taxing and spending at record highs. If you somehow manage to increase that a bit more, is that really going to lead to the stability that she's talking about overall? But I do think her message will resonate with a lot of people after years of the pandemic and, even longer stagnant wages with the inflation crisis, the cost of living crisis. People will like this idea of security. I just think that, to Paul's point, things would have to go perfectly and quite different from how they have in the past in order for her to achieve a lot of this. And this is quite a left-wing agenda. You know, she didn't just criticize the Tories from the past 14 years. People suggesting it was some comparison to Thatcher, that was ridiculous. I mean, she was very critical of the Thatcher years, and she was really critical of the Blair and Brown years. It was a rejection of neoliberalism, as you say.
That's perhaps testament to the Labour spinners, though, who spun it to the Tory press as her posing as a Thatcherite, when she actually hadn't said anything.
I mean, a lot of people have been talking about how she's going to continue with Jeremy Hunt's fiscal rule that debt has to be falling as a percentage of GDP in the medium term. That is a very loose fiscal rule.
I'm working on scenarios for the research I do, nothing to do with Labour, but my own research. I could show you how we could borrow and spend £200-300 billion and still have debt falling at the end of 5 years.
It's a joke. It's such a loose fiscal rule, and I think that Jeremy Hunt and Rishi Sunak have got away with it because they really do, especially post Liz Truss, command a certain kind of security with the markets that have let them get away with this. No reason to think immediately Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves wouldn't. They haven't done anything to upset the markets yet. But this is a very loose fiscal rule. And I've always thought to myself, if Jeremy Corbyn had brought in this fiscal rule, I don't think markets would have responded as well.
Jeremy Corbyn's fiscal rule was tighter.
It's a very strange situation we're in, where debt's just going to keep rising and rising and rising, and we have to service it. It goes back to this point about no money. It's a boring point to make, but it really is true. So that private investment is going to be critical. Is Rachel Reeves willing to do the things that she'll need to do, not just to woo business, but to keep it here, going back to that point about tax credits, going back to that point, corporation tax. You know, if you want to talk about workers' wages, there's plenty of evidence that the higher corporation taxes, the more comes out of workers' wages. These are the questions labor will have to grapple with. And is policy going to be based on things that sound nice and sound maximizing for your average worker, or is it going to be based in results? Those are not always the same thing. And if they want to see enough success by the end of their first term to get a second, some of these tax pledges that they end up making may not sound, if they want to be successful, may not be as left-wing as a lot of their supporters would like.
Isn't that the real weakness with Rachel Reeves's vision, is that all this workers, the emphasis on workers, is it's not American Bidenomics, it's old-fashioned European social democratic economics. And that has problems with employment, as we see with employment all over Europe.
I'm a proud social democrat. I'm a rare person on the Labour left who describes themselves as a social democrat. Because I think the power of social democracy in a period where you've got Russia, menacing our democracy, trying to undermine it, where every aspect of social conflict is weaponized by our enemies, it's really important to be able to hold it together. And in fact, I'd say what I criticize about Biden's Democratic Party is that there is no social democratic heart to it. It's a bunch of liberal capitalists and a bunch of really quite sort of movementist, almost narcissist sort of single issue people. And they haven't been able to defend what you might call the American polity through political economy. And therefore, I would say the first thing, whether you like Rachel's idea or not, that's the guiding force behind it. And that's why workers' rights are so important. Because I think, personally, I think, and I'm not the only one, there are professional economists who think this, that the biggest challenge for Bidenomics, Securionomics, is too much growth. That is, the output gap's only less than minus 1%. We're pushing at where the OBR thinks the economy can, the limits of where the economy can grow. What do you get in such situations? You don't get, after 30 years of neoliberalism, you don't get whole-scale wage push inflation, but you do get sectoral wage push inflation. And if you could, I can see it now because I've been involved in the conversations and I'm a lifelong trade unionist. Labour will have to go to key trade unions in key, like say civil nuclear. We've got to build a lot of nuclear power, okay? The GMB and Unite organize, and Prospect, the three unions, organise that. And it'll have to go to them and say, look, we can't have your guys and girls doubling their wages overnight. Because that's entirely, there'll be huge, there'll be a bonanza, just like there was in the North Sea oil. So you've got to say to them, look, in return for wage restraint, going back to the Harold Wilson era, in return for wage restraint, you get other things. You get partnership. You get a say in the way this industry can operate. You've got some good ideas. That old style social democratic deal with organized labor, I think, will be something that spectators, readers and the viewers of this might be quite surprised to see how useful it is in a period where the taps are, not the taps of public spending, but the taps of private investment suddenly switch on. It can be, as it was in the 1930s, quite an important thing to maintain order over what is effectively a reindustrialization project.
Does it work in a high immigration society? Because that's the usual
criticism.
Good
question, isn't it? That's a great question. Well, we've suddenly, thanks to Rishi Sunak, we are a very high immigration
society. Thanks to Brexit, it seems.
Yeah, very high immigration society, 700,000 net. I'd reverse the question. I think the current government is over-relying on labour force issues. It got itself off the hook in this budget by predicting that people would return to work. In the previous budget, it managed to stimulate some, 1.3 million people actually arrived since Brexit. So I don't think that level of immigration, this is not a political point where people on the right would say it's not sustainable because of cultural reasons.
Not everyone on the right.
Our country is quite malleable in terms of culture. It's not going to be, you're just going to flatline your GDP per head, even if you raise your GDP. And I don't know anybody in Labour who thinks that's a good idea. So what you've got to do, I think, get nitty gritty, and you'll be aware of this. The boring nitty gritty of making this work is reallocating labour from one sector to another. It's getting anybody watching this at university, about to graduate on a STEM course. We know what you want to do. You want to go and be a data analyst in a bank in the city, even though you studied engineering. We are going to try and persuade you to do engineering. That's because these nuclear power stations won't build themselves. The new frigates for the Royal Navy will not build themselves.
There's the tension, Paul, but there's the tension. I agree with you that we are going to, realistically speaking, especially as we have advancements in tech and AI, see people move from one kind of job to another. But then at the same time, if the state is playing such an active role with the unions in trying to restrict wages, hold down wages, not let usual market mechanisms take their work, doesn't just fill me with worry based on sort of the ethics of that for your average worker, who I think should be able to get as much pay as they're going to be offered for their skill set. But it's not going to make that transition as seamless as it could be. I'm more worried about that than I am about the migrants. And I would say that because I'm pretty pro-immigration. But also, at a time where we have 900,000 job vacancies, we just aren't seeing that suppression of wages from the immigration numbers. And those immigration numbers, a few years post-COVID, are expected to come down quite significantly.
I don't want to give the wrong impression. I don't think the deal with the unions is primarily to hold back wages. And there's nothing you can do about wages in, for example, data analytics. You want to go and work at Google DeepMind over in King's Cross, there's an open invitation to anybody who wants to go and work there can get a job there, if you're the right qualification. It's more that the reallocation of labour from one sector to another. It's a problem that I'm studying the 1930s at the moment, and the cabinet had discussions. What do we do? We've got same set of people. We want them in the army in rearmament period, in the army or in the reserve. We want them in the defence industry, and we also want them in the civil industry without disruption. And the cabinet sort of had this moment looking. It's in there in the minutes. They won't move under their own accord. And the national government actually considered compelling people to move. No, we can't do that. But what we can do is we can have a conversation with skills providers, with the rising Gen Z, consuming Gen Alpha, the next generation, about what the rewards are. And so the rewards of good work and stable work and long-term security at work, because how many graduates are riding Deliveroo bikes? And I don't belittle that job. It's a job. But wouldn't it be better if some of them moved to the things that would be high value for them?
So is Securonomics, to a certain extent, saying ditch your dreams of great prosperity, will give you safety instead?
I don't think it's saying that. It's saying it is saying that, and if you read Rachel's speech, it's full of references to security, not just the general concept, but actual national and geopolitical security. That is what my wing of Labour, which is I describe myself as a Bevanite, a Nye Bevanite. Remember, Nye Bevan, pro-NATO, pro-rearmament, in the end, pro-war at the end of the 30s. It was state intervention for a social and socio-economic goal. Look, I'm no doubt there are people in the Spectator who would hate that idea, but it isn't the same kind of... It's not Corbynism. It's the idea of we need to deliver security to people because what's driving them to the extremes, and in some you've seen it in some recent events in Britain, people becoming manic about things that they're not going to be able to change. What's driving them to that is their feeling of powerlessness and ultimately the feeling that the economy, that they have no stake in the economy. And so I think that's it. Wouldn't you rather have safe streets, clean energy, high growth, free education, free healthcare? That's it. That's nothing else. That's the offer. Wouldn't you rather have that than the dream of becoming a kind of premiership football player, which most people can never achieve?
I think you've just summed it up so nicely, and I suppose this is where the philosophy comes in. And this is the interesting thing about the Mace Lecture, is that it's not meant to put forward lots of public policy. It's meant to see vision. Because what you just described clearly is a very passionate thing for you, whereas for me, asking people, telling people that you can either have a functioning, secure state or you can have your dreams of prosperity, I just don't buy that it is one or the other. Of course, healthcare and education aren't free. You're paying through that through your taxes. So we need the growth and prosperity to keep those things going. And Freddie, I think the Securenomics and specifically what Rachel Rees has laid out this week is that real question of economic freedom or security. We usually talk about freedom versus security in much broader terms, but I think she is talking about the economic one. And this idea that you want to make that baseline economy too big to fail, nothing will ever go terribly wrong, but nothing will ever go gangbusters right. That's a world I don't think I want to live in.
Why does Denmark have no Novo Nordisk? You know, this company that makes the pens that you can lose weight with, their output alone has radically altered the GDP profile of Denmark. That is one successful company, in a small country, obviously, has changed Denmark's economy. Now, we need 10...
With a stable population, go back to the immigration.
Enough, but I don't think that's really the necessary and the complete condition for that. But it's we need 10 Novo Nordisks, and we don't have them. And what I think you saw last night is, at the very least, we're all three now sitting around a table in this venerated institution talking about a concept called Securenomics that most people haven't heard of, but we kind of know what it now means. And we know what its dynamics are. And I can tell you that the people in the Labour kind of, influencing kind of zone are all pretty well aware of what the weaknesses are and the limitations are. And they know it's all about execution. And they also know that, most of them have not been business executives. None of them have been generals. None of them have been Bank of England chiefs. We're not replete with executors. Mm-hmm. And therefore, finding some is going to be important. And the last thing I say is that, if this goes right, I'm afraid, Kate, what will happen is that a new consensus will occur, will emerge around it, and there'll be a conservative version of it. I think there almost already is. I would really think that, lurking out there in the world of PopCon, NatCon, there are people who are not that libertarian about economics and would quite like a secure
I don't think you even have to say libertarian. I think you could probably just say not that conservative or not that even centre-right. I think it's fascinating that in the United States, Joe Biden and Donald Trump are not terribly far away from each other on the economy. But I would think you wouldn't like that, Paul, because the assumption there is that there is something Trumpian about it, right? There is something Trumpian about this idea that we're going to use the state to benefit us. We think we know what's right. To your point, if you get it right, you might get some credit, although for how long that goes right for is a big question. My suspicion is if you want those 10 companies, like Denmark having one, to come to the UK, they need to have some opportunity for risk. I also think you should go see Nye at the National Theatre because they sing and dance about the NHS.
Yeah, well, I haven't seen it yet.
We better wrap it up there, but thank you very much.